Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving holiday. It seems that the whole world is either shopping or watching football, so if you're listening to the show, I salute you. You might remember last spring when I spoke with Leonard Zinn, who's the tech editor for Velo News, author of several best-selling maintenance and repair books, and generally a very knowledgeable guy. I ran out of time to discuss a couple of the topics I really wanted to cover. Since our main cycling season is over here in the Northern Hemisphere, I figured now would be a great time to bring him back for another chat. Then we're going to head on down to Virginia to speak with retired Marine Corps Reserve Engineer Rob Jones. During his tour in Afghanistan in 2010, he was injured by an IED and eventually lost both of his legs below the knee. With the true can-do attitude of a Marine, he looked for ways to get back to his prior levels of fitness and to move on with his life. As soon as his new prostheses were in place, he began indoor rowing and with his partner Oksana took a bronze medal in the 2012 Paralympics. As if that wasn't enough, though, he's decided to repay some of the organizations that have helped put him in a rowing shell and back on a bike. Yep, he's clipping into his pedals and riding cross-country to raise funds for the charities that helped him and others facing similar issues. Finally, we're going to speak with John Warden. John is the founder and president of Ride to Recovery, one of those organizations assisting Rob and hundreds, if not thousands, of other wounded warriors just like him. We're going to learn about the Ride to Recovery work, when and how it was founded, what programs it offers, and how important bicycling is to our returning warriors. So cozy up to your chewing stand, and let's head on out to Boulder, Colorado, to speak with Leonard Zinn about crank arm length, power output, and a whole lot more. It's Leonard Zinn, Part 2. Hi, Leonard. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining me.
Hi. Thank you, Diane.
Unfortunately, we didn't get to have a conversation at Interbike. We almost got there, and then I lost the sound engineer. So even though it sort of skipped some preliminaries, let's talk about your thoughts on crank arm length. What got you interested in the topic?
Well, I'm tall.
That's true.
and I have a sort of science bent. You know, I grew up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and I have a degree in physics and everything. So then it just made no sense to me that I would be working like a sewing machine, you know, turning these little circles while small guys had same length cranks as me and were, you know, going through this big range of motion. And so I always got the longest cranks I could get, which at the time were 180s when I was on national team. And Eddie B was the national team coach, Eddie Borisovich, and he did the fitting on me and said that I should have longer cranks than that. And I said, well, they don't make any longer. And he had said that he did his doctoral, or I don't know, that he went to a coaching school in Poland, and his dissertation was on the effect of crank arm length on cyclist performance, and he was really into that. And so that was 1980. It wasn't until about almost 2000, late 90s, that I managed to find somebody that would make custom cranks for me.
Let's talk about how you go about determining what is the right crank arm length for a rider. This is a huge topic among people buying custom bikes especially. Obviously, a manufacturer is going to pick six sizes, and he might have a 170, a 172.5, and a 175 available, you know, throughout those six sizes. But we're looking at something very different when you have a tiny rider or a very tall rider. And how do you determine what is the proper crank arm length?
I do it kind of in the range between 20.5% and 21.5% of the rider's inseam length. And I have a little bit of a range there just so that, you know, I can base it kind of on different things, the type of riding they do, the sort of flexibility they have. If they've got a big lunge muscle, you know, then I know that they won't be able to have their knees come up as high because they'll hit their belly.
Yep. A lunge muscle, that's good. I was like, all right, what is that? Now, that's a good term. I like it. I'm adopting it. Can I adopt it? A lunch muscle.
I got it from Andy Pruitt.
No, it's great. It's an awesome term. I love it. Do you think some of these manufacturers should be offering more crank arm lengths? Or do you think, well, starting with Shimano and Campy, should they be offering a, well, you can get a 165, but do you think you should offer 167.5 and 170 and, you know, on up?
I think that the ones in the range that they offer, you know, is sufficient 165. Yeah, there is a 167.5 missing, so yeah, that should be in there. But 170, 172.5, 175, Campy now stops there. SRAM and Shimano go 177.5 and 180, but that is such a puny range percentage-wise when you consider the percentage-wise difference in adult leg lengths that that yeah, they should fill in the 167.5, but really, I'm not going to tell them how they should run their business. I understand the reasoning for not offering more, but I'm clear that that a lot of people would benefit from very short people. It's pretty hard to turn a 165 around if you're, you know, if you're 4'11" or 5 feet or something like that.
Right,
that,
right.
The range of motion that they're, you know, and that's one reason why then the bikes have to have really high handlebars, plus either in combination of too long of a top tube and too shallow of a head angle and a really long fork break, all that in order that their toe doesn't hit the front tire. And a lot of that would be eliminated if they had a shorter crank. And so the bike fit, the bike performance, bike handling would be better, as well as they, you know, wouldn't have nearly as much hamstring extension and their knees not coming up so high into their chest. And then on the long end, you know, those people, it just makes no sense that, you know, if you consider a Tour de France winner, those riders tend to have about a 21.5%, their crank's about 21.5% of their inseam length, and repeat Tour de France winners, and that clearly that works fine for them. And for somebody like me to have a 180, that's about 18%, and so I'm just the extension contraction percentage wise of my leg muscles and the angular change of my hip and knee angles is quite a bit less, and it seems to me that I'm leaving a lot on the table just from a biomechanical perspective, that if it were more efficient to use less extension and less range of angles, then I think that Tour de France winners sort of would have gravitated toward that. And that's a part of it. And then the other part is that you know, for instance, Lance Armstrong brought in the whole really high cadence thing into the tour. And the idea of that was that your peak forces would be lower at a given power output because you were putting in less force on each pedal stroke to generate that same amount of power, so you didn't produce as much lactate for going the same speed. But a big rider like Jan Ulrich tried to do that high cadence thing, and it just didn't work for him. His legs were just too big and heavy, and it just wasn't efficient. But so even riders much taller and bigger and heavier than Jan Ulrich, that applies even more so, that it's inefficient to spin those big heavy legs around at a high cadence. But if you have a longer crank, then you get greater leverage. So the same argument applies: at a lower cadence, you're just like it. It's much easier to pull a stuck nail out of a board with a crowbar than it is with a little short claw hammer.
Right, right.
It takes less force to keep the crank turning, so that you, at a lower cadence, you can still produce this great power with a lower peak forces and hence lower lactate. And if your legs are long enough to efficiently turn it, then and you're turning through same range of motion that people have been winning tours on for years, then why not?
I'm speaking with Leonard Zinn. He's up in Boulder, Colorado. He is the tech editor for Velo News and also has his own line of bikes, his own line of cranks. So let me ask you about the ability to pedal up to those RPMs. So the prevailing theory is sort of the longer the crank arm, the harder it is to get going. But once you get going, you know, you've got this powerful sort of lever going. And shorter crank arms allow you, of course, to turn a lower gear. If we're talking about somebody who isn't racing a bike, somebody who normally is just riding club rides on weekends, although they're all weekend warriors, of course, they all think they're racing a bike, would you opt for shorter over longer if it was available, or longer over shorter? And I know that's kind of a weird question, but let's say you have your choice of 172.5 or 175, and that 20.5% falls somewhere in there. Would you opt for longer or shorter? What would make you choose one over the other?
Well, I'll be kind of do a sort of a broader thing. Like for mountain bikes, you know, basically all mountain bikes have 175 cranks.
Right.
Doesn't matter the size. That's what you get. And I believe that a little bit shorter end of the range is useful for most mountain bike riding because you have so many changes, quick changes in speed from going into dips and out of dips and stuff like that, that it's nice to be able to spin it up quickly and that's useful. Of course, some probably for a lot of mountain bike races, you'd actually be better off with a longer crank because a lot of them are on the side of ski hills and you just have this long climb, not much change in tempo. And the main thing would be, definitely, if your legs are long enough to turn them, the leverage gives you more ability to get up a big climb better. And then downhill, you have this longer stance, longer platform to support you when you're standing, descending. For the road, I think it's more of an individual thing than that. Some people just naturally turn a low cadence. Some people naturally spin along. And while coaching and suggestions and all that can help, a lot of it is sort of your body does have a sense of what's most efficient for you. And a lot of times when we're real newbies, probably, yeah, your body's sense of efficiency isn't probably making any difference. But when you've been doing it for a while, I think there's a certain amount that you can trust in what your body sort of naturally gravitates toward. And if you tend to be a spinner, then yeah, I'd say use a little shorter cranks. If you tend to be a gear masher, yeah, you'd use more toward the 21.5% than the 20.5% one. And but if you start doing this with people, you'll discover, you know, if you have a 100-centimeter inseam, well, that's either between a 205 and a 215, right? 20.5 and 21.5%.
That's pretty long.
That's pretty long.
So you need a big bike with a high bottom bracket or you're smacking your pedals on the ground.
Exactly. Yeah, the bike's got to be designed along with it. And the same goes for really small people that, you know, if you got a 75-centimeter inseam or 70-centimeter inseam, you're gonna have a crank that's way below what you're going to find anywhere. You
right.
140 millimeter range. And I find that when you actually do make a bike that is designed for the particular crank and you do a crank that's in this range for people, that they're very happy. That really short people really like the smaller circle, turning in the smaller circle, and the really big guys, yeah, they definitely appreciate it. It feels more natural to them. They tend to go faster and be happier.
Just to put it in perspective, what's the shortest and longest crank arm lengths you have produced from your company?
We've made 250 millimeter.
Whoa.
Long end, and we made a lot of 130s. I'm pretty sure we made 100 millimeter once, though.
Wow.
And I know we did because I pedaled it for a while. I ride all these lengths myself and just see what I feel like. And it's, you know, it's actually pretty amazing how much power you could produce with a 100 millimeter crank, and it naturally encourages you to spin at 200 RPM. It's real easy to spin it at 200 RPM.
That's crazy. It sounds crazy. Well, that's a good discussion about crank arm length. I think that really fills in the gaps for me. When we also spoke last April, we talked a little bit about new technologies, and we spent some time talking about Rode Disc. So we were at the show. Rode Disc is coming along. Do you think it's actually happening? Do you think it's still an okay idea, not an okay idea? Anybody doing a better job than anybody else with it? I remember what you said last time. I just want to see if you've changed your thinking.
I mean, there's no question it's coming big time. It's coming. And in cyclocross, all you have to do is look at what all the manufacturers are speccing, and it's there. And, you know, I personally have a cyclocross bike with disc brakes and two of them with cantilever brakes, and there's no question that the braking is better on the disc brake bike. Also no question that the bike is considerably heavier. And so altogether weighs a good 2.5-3 pounds more than those other bikes, which if I really cared about my cyclocross results, I would be loath to use that bike on any other than conditions that really mandated it. But, Sven Ness said, it's like having a bike with two extra water bottles on it, full water bottles, and that's just too much to be lugging around on your back. But anyway, that's cyclocross, which it's coming in cyclocross, and we're going to all have disc brakes in a few years, whether we like it or not on that. It's just going to be like with the mountain bike. But with road, all I can say is with my own business, building bikes for really big guys, we're making tons of them with disc brakes, and that's not because I'm encouraging them, because I'm sort of very much on the fence about it. But it's that I make these bikes for big guys, and they tend to explode tires and stuff like that on long descents. In particular, the combination of a big guy, a lot of weight going downhill, but also maybe isn't kind of braking like a bike racer would, where he's completely letting off in between the turns.
Right.
He's riding the brakes the whole time. The heating gets enormous on the brake surface. And yeah, if that's a rim, then you're going to tend to explode the tires if you're a 280-pound guy going down a big mountain. But their thought that disc brake would eliminate the tire explosion problem, maybe. But the heat issue still, I don't think, is fully addressed for guys like that. Those are going to be the guys that are super attracted to it. And, you know, with a mountain bike, and you have a really big guy, you just put much bigger rotors on the bike. But the forks are designed for big rotors, and the forks and frames are, and they're widely available. But with disc road, the forks, I don't know of any forks other than maybe there's a whiskey maybe that will go to a 180, but all the forks are designed for a maximum of 160 millimeter rotor.
Right.
Well, 160 millimeter rotor, on a mountain bike, if you have a 250-pound aggressive rider, that's not a big enough rotor.
Right.
And on a road bike, they're going faster than they are on a mountain bike, and sometimes they got to stop faster too if there's more interactions with cars and that sort of thing on the road than you have on a mountain bike anyway. So the heat issue is a big deal, and if a hydraulic brake gets too hot, the fluid boils, and when the fluid boils, then it's no longer a hydraulic brake, because the whole idea of a hydraulic is that fluids are non-compressible, but gases are compressible. That's why we have pneumatic tires, and if you boil the fluid, then your lines are full of gas, and when you pull the lever, there's nothing happening. And I've had it happen with me with hydraulic road disc brakes, and I'm only 170 pounds, but on some really steep switchbacks near here, my brakes completely faded. It's an issue that I don't think is completely handled by any means. You know, SRAM has a has an elegant hydraulic disc brake system, but 160 is the maximum rotor size. And, you know, they have a, they've said the maximum weight is 250 pounds for the rider.
That sounds high.
Yeah, I don't know. But, I mean, still, the people that are going to want that are the people who, the weight of them alone is 250 pounds
right.
or more. And Shimano has a, their brake, they have these Ice-Tech rotors, which are meant to deal with the heat by having all these cooling fins on them and all that, which I think is a great idea. And they've said that 140 millimeter basically works for everybody. Well, the thing I like about that is that then that means that I could put a 160 millimeter Ice-Tech rotor on there, and if they say 140 is going to work for most people, then I could feel a lot more confident with a 160 with a really big guy. And I think this whiskey fork will go to a 180, and I could get a 180 mountain bike, maybe mountain bike Shimano rotor and Ice-Tech rotor, and deal with the heat better that way too. So that's sort of the most promising thing that I've seen for big riders. I do think that when you don't talk about the heat, that, yeah, rainy days, all that sort of thing, same arguments have always been there for disc brakes, that you're going to have better braking, no question. But roadies on the other end of the spectrum who are not big, big guys don't really care about bike weight so much, but small guys do, and racers and all that. And right now, there's a considerable weight penalty they have to pay for a road disc brake, and then it's pretty hard for anybody to make an argument that there's not a significant aerodynamic cost as well, because the wheels have to be built with more spokes,
right?
And then you've got this rotor and this caliper sitting out there in the wind as well.
Let's talk about your column for a second. How do you come up with the questions? People do ask these questions for real, right? You don't make them up.
Oh yeah, no, they really do. And you know, I think that I've been doing that column for a long time, more than 10 years now. And I think over time it's certainly changed. Initially it was all very, how do you make this work? How do you do that kind of thing? And now there's very often, it gets into long discussions about, like the one last week was about shimmy and whether high speed shimmy on the bike is actually resonance phenomenon, oscillating, resonating, where the bike and the rider, you know, reach this point where you have a resonance frequency that's building and building. Or this math professor wrote in that it's this thing called a hop bifurcation, and made great arguments for why it wasn't resonance. And that sort of thing I find super interesting, and apparently a lot of readers do, because, boy, I got a ton of emails about that this week. And
do you tell people to clamp their knees on the top tube?
Yeah, and actually there's an even more effective thing that they can do, which is to basically decouple the front and rear wheels by pushing their butt so far off the saddle, back off the saddle, they have as close to zero weight on the front wheel as possible, because it requires this feedback between the two wheels for it to happen. And if you, it's like a, you know, a kid's telephone made with two tin cans with a string between the two. If you remove the tension on the string, there's no vibration that goes down it. You can't use the telephone, but if you pull it tight, you can. And so if you, can essentially have all 100% of your weight on the rear wheel, you can stop a pretty nasty shimmy. But it takes a pretty big leap of faith when the thing is just scaring the heck out of you and going down the hill and just shaking like mad. And for somebody to then have the presence of mind when everything is telling you, God, I got to put the brakes on and get out of this. And, you know, braking
right.
very often makes it worse.
Right.
And, but anything actually to change your weight distribution. Sometimes maybe just leaning down hard, you know, on the front where it maybe isn't as scary as pushing yourself off the back often can do it. And certainly, yeah, your knees to the top tube deadens the vibration some, but there's been plenty of people that have contacted me that crashed really badly at high speed in one of these deals where they did put their knees to the top tube and it was not sufficient to slow them down.
It's a scary phenomenon. It scares the living hell out of people. I know that. So I have one more question about your column, and that is, what is the weirdest question you were ever asked? Do you know? Do you remember? I know. I ask weird questions too, and that's a weird one.
Yeah, I mean, there's some questions that just scare the crap out of me, where people say, hey, well, can I do this with this, you know? And like one, well, just yesterday I got one where somebody wanted to use a Shimano hydraulic disc brake with a SRAM lever or vice versa. I can't remember which it is, but you know, the two work on completely different fluids. And so you would actually, it's a really terrible idea because either the seals would shrink or they'd expand, or but in any case it wouldn't work the way they're supposed to.
Right. And you're contaminating them basically.
Yeah. So there's ones that are scary, and a lot of those I don't run. I just answer the person directly.
Right. Say, oh, yeah, like don't give people this idea. Right.
But in terms of just a really weird question, I can't think of one specific one that stands out. But
okay.
Of many that
well, but just those two comments were good enough, you know, that oh, I can't even do this one in public because it'll give somebody some ridiculous idea and then they're going to go flying off a cliff or something. So did you see anything that you absolutely thought was awesome at Interbike?
Yeah, that I thought was incredible was this flexible solar panel that you can take into the backcountry and recharge all your electronic gadgets with. And it's, it's done by Bushnell Outdoors. And it really charges just as fast as plugging it into the wall.
Wow.
And the thing's totally flexible, and you can tear it, and it still continues to work and fold it. And, you know, there are other backcountry solar panels, but they're all stiff and big, and this thing just, it's the size of a hair curler.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Awesome.
So that was the coolest thing.
Well, it's pretty exciting to talk to you again. It's a lot of fun. I always learn something new, and I learned a lot today. That was great. And holidays are coming up, so I hope you have a happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, too.
Thank you, and you have a great evening.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Leonard Zinn joined me from his home in Boulder, Colorado. I'm going to take a short break on The Outspoken Cyclist, and I'll be right back.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On Monday, December 9th, from 6 to 9 p.m., the Northeast Ohio Cycling Community, with support from the Outspoken Cyclist, is hosting a fundraiser for the Cleveland Food Bank at La Taqueria on Wilson Mills Road in Highland Heights, featuring food, beverages, and a silent auction. All event proceeds will go to support the Cleveland Food Bank. Ticket holders are also asked to bring two non-perishable food items for donation. Ticket and more information at OutspokenCyclist.com or at SignMeUp.com. Search for Cleveland, Ohio events.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. We're going to scurry right on down to Virginia and talk with retired Marine Corps Reserve Engineer Rob Jones about his epic adventure and what happened when he was in Afghanistan. Good evening, Rob. Thanks for joining me on The Outspoken Cyclist. How are you this evening?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. It's a little cold and drizzly and rainy up here, but I'll bet it's pretty where you are in Virginia.
Yeah, it's not too bad. It was a nice day for a ride.
Aha. Well, your story is inspiring and your goal is wonderful. And since it involves bicycles, it's perfect for the show. I want to know more about your story and you and how you actually chose a bicycle to tell it. Tell us about... Start with your enlisting in the Marines and walk us through what has happened up until now.
I enlisted in 2006 as a combat engineer. I did two deployments, one to Iraq, 2008, and then one to Afghanistan in 2010. In Afghanistan, I was hit by an IED that resulted in double above knee amputations. I did my recovery at Walter Reed, and I retired from the Marines in 2011. Then I got a bronze medal in the Paralympics last year in rowing, and now I am riding my bike across America for a charity.
So we're going to sort of back up a little bit and try and fill in, kind of flesh out some of these areas. So you seem to have bounced back rather quickly. You must have one hell of a great attitude.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess I just decided I was going to survive, so I might as well make the best out of what I have.
How long between the time of the injury till you received the prosthetics that have allowed you to do some of the things you're doing now?
I think I started trying to ride a bike again maybe 5 or 6 months after I got hurt. I got my walking knees maybe 4 months afterwards, rowing legs probably a year afterwards.
So you have different prosthetics for different applications.
Yeah, no prosthetic really works for everything. So it's better just to have one set for different specific purposes.
So let's talk about rowing for a second. So rowing was really kind of your first, you really sort of fell in love with it, and you actually had a partner to go to the Paralympics with. Is that right? Did I get that part right?
Yeah, I had I rode in what's called a trunk and arms mixed double skull, so I had a partner, yeah.
And so how many people competed in that race with you where you came home with the bronze?
Well, there were 12 countries all participated, but there were a lot more that tried to qualify, but only 12 were actually qualified.
Wow, it seems like you did a pretty good job in a pretty short period of time, because the Paralympics happened right after the regular Olympics, as I remember, and that was only a year ago.
Yeah, so we trained for about 9-10 months full-time. Then I did about 6 or 7 months before that kind of training, what I would say part-time.
Let's talk a little bit about the bicycle, because I know what it takes to ride a bicycle without lower legs, which is pretty much what you are, you know, dealing with. How did you get your balance on a bicycle? Do your prosthetic legs, feet actually clip to a bicycle, or do you just use a pedal like a platform?
No, I use Speedplay light action clips. They're kind of glued on. It's not glue, but it's this special prosthetic stuff that attaches them to the bottom of a prosthetic foot.
Wow. Speedplay are wonderful pedals. I mean, you know, they're great for a lot of applications. I didn't know that. Well, did you have problems with balance? Did you find that it was easy to get back on a bike and start riding again?
Well, I guess the hardest part is getting started. If we did it like, you know, your parents used to do it, where they held the bike up and pushed you along, it's really not that hard.
Right.
Once you get the prosthetic set up correctly. But, yeah, doing it on your own, it's a little bit tricky. I mean, at first, but now it's, I mean, obviously it's really easy for me, but when you're first learning, it's kind of a weird feeling, so you're not exactly sure it's going to work, but then eventually I just had to go for it, and the technique that I used worked, and I just kind of worked on it, and now I can do it pretty easily.
Are other people asking you about that? You know, are other people coming up to you and saying, hey, you know, I've got the same issue, can you help me learn how to ride a bike again?
Not really. One or two guys from the hospital that I wasn't in the hospital with them, but they're at the hospital now, Walter Reed that is, have asked me about it, and I explained it to them. I couldn't show them at the time, but I explained it to them, and obviously the prosthetist there, and a lot of people there saw me do it, so they could kind of help them too, but if they haven't figured it out by the time I'm done with my ride, then I'm sure I can help give him a hand.
What kind of bike are you riding? And we're going to talk about your journey right now, this journey where you want to raise $1 million to give back to these organizations who have helped you. What kind of bike is it?
Just a carbon fiber bike. It was given to me by one of the charities I'm raising money for. They have their own line of bikes that they make. So it's not any kind of brand that you'll find in the store.
What's the charity name?
Ride to Recovery.
Oh, I know about Ride to Recovery. I think who manufactures that bike. So that, yeah, they do a lot of R&D for people who need the kind of help you do. That's cool. So do you like it? Do you like the bike?
Yeah, it's a great bike. I've made some changes to it, though. Like I put flat mountain bike handlebars on it, and I put pretty much made it a mountain bike geared road cycle. So I put mountain bike cassettes on it front and back, and then I also have the flat handlebars in the front. So I guess maybe it's kind of like a cyclocross bike almost.
Yeah, so you lowered the gearing on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you do that, just out of curiosity?
Because, you know, road cycles only have the two gears in the front usually, so I needed that third one I needed the low gears to help me get up hills because I don't have all the strength, as much strength as most people.
I'm going to take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Rob Jones. He's down in Mechanicsville, Virginia, and he is embarking across the United States on a bicycle, raising money for the charities that have helped put him back on a bicycle after he was injured in Afghanistan. So let's talk about your journey, and it's already started.
Yeah, it started in October.
Last month. So Are you on that journey now? Are you?
Yeah.
Okay. So you started where?
Far Harbor, Maine.
And you're now in Virginia. So where are you hoping to end up? I think you're going cross country and then going down the coast of California, right?
Right. So the cross portion, I guess, will end in San Francisco and then down to the border with Mexico.
Wow. How many miles is that?
It's 5,400 total.
Wow, that's a long trip. Do you have a goal of a date, an end date? Do you know when you want to be done?
Not exactly. If I keep up 30 miles a day, then I'll be done around April to May. But however long it takes me, that's how long I'll do it for.
How is the ride being financed? And then how are people – well, let's talk about financing the ride first. And then we'll talk about, you know, getting the people who are helping you to raise the money.
I just bought everything myself. I just bought a box truck, some water, some food. Already had the bike. Already had most of the clothes. I just bought everything myself, but a lot of the times hotels have been comping me hotel rooms. And
oh, that's
people
nice.
Have been bringing me food and stuff, so that helps out a lot.
And who's driving your truck?
My little brother's driving the truck.
Nice.
Yep.
That's really nice. So you are staying in hotels. Has anybody said, oh, come stay with me, you know, like other people along the way? Or are you specifically staying with just motels and hotels?
Yeah, I've done that a few times. When it's offered, I'll do it. But, if it's not too far of a drive. But
Right.
Yeah, a lot of the times hotels will count me a room.
So are you talking with people along the way? You're riding 30 miles, and I don't know, that's not all day long. I mean, it doesn't take you 8 hours to ride 30 miles, right?
No, it takes me about four.
Yeah. So when you get to a town, are you actually meeting with people who are interested in your journey? Is there sort of like an advance notice of you getting to a town?
A lot of times I have PR people working with me. So if there's any interest in a town, then a lot of the times I'll meet with press. Sometimes people set up meet and greets at churches or, just wherever, American Legions, that kind of stuff. So if there's any interest, then I do. But if there isn't, then, I'll just kind of go through anonymously, I guess.
Yeah. You know what? It's probably hard to be anonymous. Is your truck painted? Does it have cool things on the side of it?
It's this white truck, but I have letters on it that spell out some stuff, and I have a section on it that says how many miles I've gone, how many miles I have to go, and I have stickers and stuff like that.
Cool, cool. So who's going to benefit from the money you're raising, and how are you raising money?
The three charities are Ride to Recovery, the Semper Fi Fund, and the Coalition to Salute America's Heroes. They're all veterans charities, and the best way to donate would be to go out on my website, and you can just donate online.
Yes, it's robjonesjourney.com. Robjonesjourney.com. Yeah, no, I have the website right up in front of me, and you've raised already almost $36,000.
Yeah, it's probably a little bit more at this point. I haven't updated that in a little bit, but I try and update it every 10 days or so.
Got it. Got it. Well, are you enjoying the ride?
You know, as much as you can enjoy, you know, riding 4 hours every day, but yeah, for the most part, it hasn't been that bad.
Well, you're going to be hitting some weather soon. Are you going to take the Southern Tier, or are you going to just go straight across the country? You're in Virginia now, so you're going to head across the South?
No, I'm going straight across.
So you're going to hit some weather soon, huh?
Well, we'll see, I guess.
Well, I appreciate you talking with me. I wish you a lot of luck. You know, there are a lot of people who not only respect but have a lot of good feelings for retired military, and especially for people who sacrifice like you do, and we thank you.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. You have a great evening. Have a wonderful trip, and I'll tell you what, we'll try to check in when you reach the West Coast. How's that?
Sounds great.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Rob Jones joined me from Virginia. He is partway through that trip across the country, riding 30 miles a day on a specially adapted bike that was put together by Ride to Recovery, which leads me right into our next interview. We're going to head on out to California and speak with founder and president of Ride to Recovery, John Warden. John, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thank you very much for having me.
I just finished an interview with Rob Jones, and of course, Ride to Recovery is a big part of his life right now. Give us a brief background on the organization and what it does. I know you're the founder and you're the president.
Yes, Ride to Recovery started in 2008 as a unique cycling-centric mental and physical rehab program for the wounded soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. We started off with the VA through a call that I received from the VA, and then shortly after got hooked up with Walter Reed from some of the therapists there and started working with the soldiers that came through there. And that's how we got hooked up with Rob when he was at Walter Reed.
So what is your background that brought you to Ride to Recovery?
Prior to Ride to Recovery, I was a professional cyclist, and I had been the organizer and manager of the Mercury Cycling professional team.
I knew your name from somewhere.
And so the therapist at the VA was a big cycling fan, and that's how he tracked me down, was he knew of me from the Mercury Cycling team.
Well, the Ride to Recovery mission statement says to improve the health and wellness of injured veterans by providing a life-changing experience that can impact their lives forever. So take us through what happened. Let's use Rob for an example. He's brought to Walter Reed, and pick it up from there.
So a kid like Rob comes through Walter Reed. He goes through the medical side. They get him all fixed up, and then he transitions into the rehabilitation side. So he starts working out with the therapist. When they get into that section, that's when they learn about Ride to Recovery. And so Rob contacted us and said that he would like to ride a bike. And the therapist there wanted to put him on a hand cycle because he's a bilateral above-the-knee amputee. And, you know, 90% of bilateral above-the-knee amputees can't ride a road bike or don't want to ride a road bike because they try to steer him into a hand cycle. Well, Rob was determined he wanted to ride a road bike. So we had a little bit of friction there. And you know, our attitude is if the soldier or the wounded warrior wants to try something, we're going to help them try it and figure out what he should or shouldn't be doing.
Well, let me ask a question about Rob in particular. Having talked to him, I know he's very determined and very kind of stubborn. This is the way it's going to be. This is what he's going to do. So explain what you had to do. I know he needed a different set of prostheses to ride the bike than he does to row his bike and to even just live his normal life.
Yeah, that's correct. And I mean, you know, to Rob's credit, you know, stubbornness can be a positive and a negative deal. I mean, a lot of people look at stubbornness as a negative thing, but if you can channel it in the right direction, it could be a very positive thing. And I think Rob is proof of that. It was because he was stubborn about it that the therapist finally relented and let him try. Because we had him on a road bike. We started him off on riding on the back of the tandem so he could get some strength and you know, get the right cycling legs so he could start riding. And then we created a special road bike for him so that he could use his prosthetic, working with the prosthetist at Walter Reed. We had the right setup for him to ride a road bike, and we had to do a little bit different with the handlebars and some other things so that his prosthetic legs didn't hit the handlebars, and special kinds of pedals and things like that so that he could easily clip in and out. And so he started riding. He loved it. And then he decided he wanted to try to do something for Ride to Recovery. And so he decided to do this cross-country ride that he started just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Just pretty amazing. You know, he's riding only 30 miles a day, which I think is a reasonable amount. But when you think about what has to go into him being on a bike and, you know, he like co-opted his brother to come help him. It's such a wonderful story. It's an awesome story. Tell me a little bit about these bikes that are being adapted. I mean, who is actually making these bikes and working with you? I think there's a whole like laboratory of people working with you, yes?
Yeah, we actually have a cycling rehab center called Project Hero that's based at Walter Reed. We have a room and we have a cycling studio. We have for all intents and purposes, it's the most high-tech bike shop in America, right on the campus of the hospital.
Cool.
And we have a technician, Ray Clark, that works there. And Ray does an awesome job with the guys there. He's got a full shop so that he can create whatever's necessary for guys to ride. And we've done some crazy stuff over the years. And
are you taking existing bikes and is then Ray like making changes to those bikes, or is he actually building bikes from scratch? Let's take a road bike, for example, and then we'll talk a little bit about hand cycles, because I think they're a fascinating topic anyway.
Well, basically what we do is we start off with a stock road bike. Now, we, for a long time, we were working creating our own brand of bikes, but now we work with Raleigh Bicycles as our official bike partner. And so we would take a Raleigh frame and probably the wheels, or maybe not the wheels, depending on, you know, we've used, we've created a disc brake road bike.
Right.
And so, you know, there's a lot of technology that goes into that. And then we've done stuff with electronic shifting to make it possible to use a triple chain ring, because normally electronic shifting, you can only use a double.
Right. Interesting.
And so, you know, we have to take what the cycling industry has and then adapt that to fit whatever the issues are with the participants.
So electronic shifting has probably made a lot of things easier, especially for cyclists who have lost upper limbs. With all of the different button locations and all of the different kind of shifting.
Electronic shifting has made it possible for a lot of guys to ride that otherwise wouldn't be able to ride. I mean, it's been revolutionary, especially like we've have a lot of quad amputees, triple amputees that are riding bikes, and it would only be possible because of the electronic shifting, because they don't have hands.
Oh, right. Oh, right. Right, 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 right. True. I'm speaking with John Warden. He is the founder and president of Ride to Recovery, one of the organizations, if not the only organization, that works with wounded soldiers coming back and getting them on bicycles. I think it's awesome. You know, I haven't heard the word girl or woman yet. Do you work with women as well as men?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And we actually have a women's initiative that we started this year back in April, specifically geared to female service members that have served our country and that need their own special kind of program for cycling.
What would that consist of? Why would it have to be different from the men's program?
Women just have a different approach. It's a little more social, a little less competitive.
Are you saying we're chatty?
You can be.
Just messing with you a little bit. How many at any one time, how many people might be in your program? And I know you have several initiatives and several programs and several things going on.
Yeah, we service about 3,000 to 4,000 a year.
Wow. Wow.
And so, you know, our biggest events are our challenge rides, and those are 200 riders. We do 7 of those rides a year. We have Project Hero like we have at Walter Reed, which is a 365-day-a-year riding program. We have that in 40 locations across the United States.
Let's talk a little bit about Rob and his attitude, because I think you probably run into this a lot. He has that let's get it done. Do you think Ride to Recovery adds more than just the physical healing? What's going on mentally and emotionally as you see these people? Because I know PTSD is one of the things that seems to respond to your work.
Correct, yes. And PTSD is probably one of our biggest and most important success stories. And we're very proud of the work that we've done in that area. But also, you know, we've had some great, great success with guys like Rob, who have a fairly significantly severe type injuries, and being able to get them physically active in a way that they can be that way for the rest of their life has also been, you know, it's sort of the mental and physical side. We get both.
Are you taking any of what you're doing and putting it into a form that's statistical, that people can use it as research, and then you can go out and say, because of this, this happens? You know, because we put this...
Oh, yeah.
This...
I mean, we definitely keep statistics on the types of injuries we serve and their success stories. I mean, a lot of the wounded warriors like Rob will write us and tell us, both male and female, about how the program has changed or shaped their life. And we do surveys after every ride to kind of get some information. And some of our sponsors also do surveys and talk about the success of the program.
And that was one of the things I wanted to talk about, is how Ride to Recovery is funded and the sponsorship. So what kinds of sponsorship? I think I saw United Healthcare as one of the sponsors, yes?
Yeah, United Healthcare is one of our biggest sponsors. The Heritage Bag Company, those are both significantly big sponsors. Raleigh Bicycles, the USO, United Airlines. There's a bunch, but the great thing is, you know, we've been, especially the last year or so, getting great support from the cycling industry. It started with Raleigh Bicycles, and then also some of my old longtime partners with the Mercury Cycling Team, like Speedplay Pedals.
Right.
And then Champion Systems is one of our partners. They do all the technical wear. Rudy Project does helmets and glasses, Stan's No Tubes, Kenda Tires.
Wow. Some big hitters.
Bar, Park Tool, Steris, Chamois Butter, the most important, Chamois Butter. Rob's using a lot of that.
I got to tell you, I was the very first Chamois Butter dealer here in Northeast Ohio, and I still stick with them. Steve Matthews is an awesome guy. You know, he's...
Steve and I go back to 1991.
Yep.
When he first started the company, my team was one of the guinea pigs, and he and I have remained friends ever since.
Well, you did a good job, because it's a great product, you know, and I don't,
is.
Yeah, I never yeah, ride
never
without it.
Underestimated.
Exactly. So the last thing I want to talk about is, you kind of alluded to it when you and I spoke on the phone before our conversation, and that is something you're going to try with Rob next year, and it just sort of blew my mind. Can you talk about that?
Sure.
Okay. Tell us about it.
You know, Rob is always, like you say, he's a man that sets a goal, and he's tenacious about following through. That's one of the great things about him. And so, you know, when he threw out the challenge of riding across country, I said, well, you know what's next, right? And so he's going to be the first double amputee, above-the-knee amputee, to try to ride the Leadville Trail 100.
Okay, what's the bike going to be like?
Well, we're gonna work with the cycling community and come up with a special kind of bike. You know, we've been working with Brian over at Da Vinci. It'll be a pretty cool setup. And so, you know, Rob gets done in June from his ride, so he'll be super fit after riding 30 miles a day every day for the last 4 or 5 months. So we're excited about it, and we'll get him on the mountain bike right away. So it'll be an interesting deal, because the pedaling part I'm not too worried about. You know, he'll be able to deal with that. It's the parts of Leadville, like power line on the way back where you have to get off the bike and hike, that's going to be a little more interesting. It's that part about if you have to get off the bike and get back on the bike, and because it's not, you know, it's not as convenient for him as it is
right.
for someone who has their legs.
It's not like he has flat ground and an easy way to get on and off. You know, you don't know where you are when you get off the bike. That's an interesting point. Interesting. Well,
yeah, I mean, I'm sure he's going to do well, and we're very excited about it. And it's a great project for our program. It's great for the Leadville Trail 100 as a race to have someone like that participating, and it's going to be cool.
Is he the first disabled athlete to do this?
No.
Okay.
We had Matt DeWitt is a double arm amputee, and he successfully completed Leadville last year in under 12 hours.
These guys are
so
unbelievable.
He became the first double arm amputee to get under 12. So that kind of showed Rob that it was possible. So now he got all fired up on it.
What a great organization. You're doing such awesome work, and I really appreciate that you talked with me. How can people find out more about Ride to Recovery? What can they do? And do you just take donations?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, we're a 501c3, so without donations, we get nowhere. And the best thing to do is go to ride2recovery.com. Right on there, there's a donate button. You can make a donation. You can mail it in. You know, we take all major credit cards.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much. Much good luck on your ongoing work. It's awesome work, and I am sure everybody who participates just is blown away every day by these amazing, amazing warriors. Thanks so much. Have a great holiday.
Yes, thanks. Thanks, Diane.
All right.
Appreciate the call.
It is my pleasure. Bye-bye, John.
All right. Bye.
John Warden joined me from his offices at Ride to Recovery. That's our show for this week. My thanks to Leonard Zinn, Rob Jones, and John Warden for taking time during the busy holiday season to speak with me. If you get a break in the weather, ride off some of those extra Thanksgiving calories. I'll be back next week with another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.